From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Opioid abuse is all over America's headlines lately. Addiction is hitting many families. As clans gather for Thanksgiving this week, we wanted to tackle it head on. How to see what's happening if a family member is succumbing to addiction, and how to respond. This hour On Point, addiction in the family. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you have an addiction problem in the family? Opioid addiction. How did you spot it? How are you responding? Will you say something at the Thanksgiving table? Where do you even start? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us first today from Washington is the Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. Vivek Murthy. Last Thursday, he released the report Facing Addiction in America, a landmark report on a problem that has grown very large. Surgeon General Murthy, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you.
We want to get into how families actually deal with this, but take us to your big message first. It's been half a century since we'd have a report quite like this, and the last time it was about tobacco. This time you're looking at opioids and addiction. What's the big message that you're looking to send to Americans as they gather this week for the holidays?
Well, thank you, Tom. With the report that we released last Thursday, I'm declaring addiction a public health crisis and calling our country to action to address it. You know, for far too long, people in America have struggled and suffered in the shadows without being able to come forward and ask for help for fear that they'll be judged. But for far too long, we've also treated addiction as a criminal justice problem instead of a public health problem. And it's time for us to change that, which is why I'm issuing this report.
When you say addiction, are you differentiating between the sources of addiction, whether alcohol or opioids or you name it?
So in the report that we issued, we cover a range of substances, from legal substances like alcohol and prescription painkillers to illicit substances like heroin, cocaine, and marijuana.
So you've got the whole range there. And among the things you're saying is one that sounded familiar to me, and yet you're putting it forward as though it's new, or maybe there's a nuance I'm missing, that this is not a moral failing, but a chronic disease. We've been hearing that for a long time. What's the nuance you want us to hear there?
Well, what I have found, Tom, when I have, in both my practice of medicine and caring for patients directly, and also as Surgeon General talking to families all across America, is that the negative attitudes and biases that surround addiction are still persistent, and we haven't fully broken through the way we need to. There are still far too many people who look at addiction as evidence of a character flaw or a moral failing. And in the report, we actually lay out very clearly that addiction is, in fact, a chronic disease of the brain. We go into the neurobiology that tells us the specific areas of the brain that are, in fact, impacted by addiction, where the circuitry is, in fact, rewired. And these areas affect our ability to make decisions, to control impulses, and ultimately govern our reward and stress systems as well.
Why do you think we're seeing such a wave of addiction in this country? Why do you think it's mounted up to a public health crisis, as you've now declared it?
I think there are several reasons why we've gotten to the point that we are today. And let's just define where we are today. We have 20.8 million people who have a substance use disorder. That is similar to the number of people who have diabetes. That is 1.5 times the number of people who have all cancers combined. But despite this, only 1 in 10 people with substance use disorders are actually getting treatment. And imagine if only 1 in 10 people with cancer were getting treatment, or 1 in 10 people with diabetes. We wouldn't tolerate such a situation, but we've allowed that to develop with substance use disorders. And here's why we got here. Number one, the stigma around substance use disorders prevented a lot of people from coming forward and asking for help and admitting they had a problem. Number two, we didn't invest enough in treatment. So we have, for example, proven treatment methods that save $4 in healthcare costs for every $1 invested and $7 in criminal justice system costs, but millions of people can't get that treatment. And lastly, we didn't invest enough in prevention programs on a community level. We have prevention programs that return up to $64 for every dollar invested, yet they are rare when you look around our country. So if we had invested more in prevention and treatment, if we had changed how we thought about addiction, we wouldn't be in this place. But it's not too late for us to act, and that's why I issued this report.
I guess I'm
call to action.
Yeah, I get everything you're saying there, and but I'm still wondering why. Why now? If it's not, a lot of people look at this, as you say, and think, well, there's a weakness in falling for this stuff. if we've got a bigger problem now than we've had in the past, what is that? Is it about something within us, in our mindset? Is it simply about availability? What's going on?
Well, I think there's several factors that have changed. We've seen in recent years, for example, that that heroin has become even more available at cheaper prices. That has certainly factored in. We've also seen that there has been a dramatic increase, in fact, a nearly fourfold increase in the quantity of opioid medications prescribed for pain, which is in part driven the addiction to prescription painkillers and has been associated with a near quadrupling in overdose deaths. So these are just a couple of the factors that have gone into the mix that have contributed to the crisis that we have now.
I want to put you directly in conversation with a caller from Detroit, if I may, Dr. Murthy, Surgeon General of the United States. You're on with Terry in Detroit. Terry, thank you for calling. What's your story?
Hi. Yeah, I lost my son to addiction a couple years ago, and still hurts. But in the process, the court system had him, the health industry, health insurance industry. We tried to get him help. I dropped him off on Christmas Eve one year of all days, and they turned around and wanted to kick him out 2 days later because he wasn't that bad.
From a treatment center, yeah.
My question, I guess, would be, why can't the health insurance companies, you know, look at the long-term mental health treatment that these kids need, not just the addiction part of it, but the mental illness? Let's just say what it is. You know, it's a mental illness along with addiction, and, you know, the kids need help.
Terry, what was the drug? What was the drug that claimed your son? And I'm sorry for it, but what was it, Terry?
He ended up getting a hold of some morphine tablets from a so-called acquaintance. And who knows, maybe his parents had it. Morphine tablets, which is...
And it took him down. Terry, I'm very sorry for that loss. Vivek Murthy, you're Surgeon General of the United States. There's a father who took his son to a treatment center on Christmas Eve, but, you know, they wouldn't keep him and kicked him out. And he's wondering about what if it's a chronic disease, how does health insurance come into this picture?
Well, Terry, first of all, thank you for sharing your story. And I am so sorry about your son. No parent should ever be in a situation where they have to bury their child. And as a dad myself, who has a young son, I my heart goes out to you. You know, I wish that your son had the treatment available to him that he needed. I wish this had never started in the first place. What I can tell you is that in this report, we are calling on insurance companies and on doctors and hospitals to do a better job of ensuring that people who need treatment can actually get it for the full duration. You know, we have a myth that some people believe in our country that you only need a couple weeks of treatment and then you're cured from any type of addiction. That is actually not how treatment for addiction works. People need acute treatment, but then they also need long-term treatment and support with medical professionals and the support of family. And without that, relapse rates are actually quite high. So I'm so sorry that treatment was not available to the extent that your son needed it, but I want you to know that is a big part of what we're pushing for here. And you should also know that there was a law recently passed, referred to as the Parity Law, which has now made it illegal for insurance companies to discriminate in how they treat addiction and mental health disorders compared with how they treat traditional medical disorders. And that's one step forward, but we got to make sure that doctors are trained in how to provide this treatment, that insurers cover it, and that hospitals integrate it with medical treatment.
You can call on hospitals and treatment centers, but that's not the same as ensuring it's going to happen. I mean, it often boils down to the business they're in. Is there a requirement that they cover treatment for addiction?
Well, so there are steps that have been taken that make that actually part of our reality. Number one, in the Affordable Care Act, we now have the provision of substance use treatment services part of what all insurance companies have to provide. Number two, the Parity Law makes sure that it's reimbursed at a level that's more commensurate with traditional medical care. But third, there has been a significant shift in our country in payment models, some of that spurred by the Affordable Care Act, but also taken on by private industry, which is now involves paying more for outcomes and value than for the quantity of services provided. And in that model, we're seeing more insurers and health systems starting to shift toward integrating substance use and mental health treatment in with traditional care.
Dr. Murthy, what's your advice for families, many gathering for Thanksgiving, of course, this week, and this could well be a circumstance in which these issues surface, or family members talk about someone in the family who needs help, or decide it's time to confront, address. You've got a portion in your report on intervention. What do you, we kind of know what that looks like from the movies, but what do you think of it?
Well, I think families have an essential role to play in helping us address addiction in America. In the report, we actually lay out specific actions that various stakeholders can take, and families are one of them. But simply starting the conversation with your loved ones about addiction can be a powerful first step, because many of the people I have met across America who are suffering with a substance use disorder, they want to talk to someone, a family member or a friend, but they worry that there's not a safe space to do that or that they may be judged. It's also important to know what signs to look out for in your loved ones. You might find that if you, for example, see mood changes, with irritability and defensiveness, if you start to see new problems at school and work in terms of attendance and performance and grades, if you see folks who have suddenly a new attitude where nothing seems to matter, or new friends that they're not telling you about, or a loss of interest and involvement in prior interests, these are all signs that something may be amiss. And it's not definitively that it's a substance use disorder, but it might be. But starting that conversation, whether it's over the Thanksgiving holidays or at other times, that can be a powerful first step to giving people a safe space to open up and ask for help.
Dr. Vivek Murthy is Surgeon General of the United States. His big report, out last week, Facing Addiction in America, you can link to at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Murthy, thank you very much for being with us today.
No problem. Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's opioid crisis and addiction in the family, how to spot it, how to respond. It's Thanksgiving week. Families are gathering. People you may not see all the time may be around. People who are around all the time may be confronted. If the family understands what's going on, do you know how to respond to that? Have you been through this yourself? Do you have some other addiction in the family? Alcohol? What's your advice to families wrestling with addiction? What's the first step, the second step, the way out? Are you the addict in the family? And does your family know? How could they best help you? With us right now from Ypsilanti, Michigan, is Aaron Bonar, clinical psychologist, specializes in addiction, treatment of substance abuse disorders, a clinical practitioner, works with couples and families and individual patients in addiction and in treatment. She's director of clinical programs at the University of Michigan's Addiction Treatment Services Clinic, assistant professor, Department of Psychiatry there. Aaron Bonar, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Baltimore is Eric Strain, Dr. Eric Strain, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Substance Abuse Treatment and Research, professor of psychiatry, behavioral sciences, and medical director of the Behavioral Pharmacology Research Unit at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. Dr. Strain, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm very grateful to both of you for being here. Do families tend to know, Aaron Bonar, when there's a problem in the family when it comes to addiction?
Some do. Not all do. So it's one of those things that can be sort of silent, and you don't always see overt signs. You might start to notice some of the things that Dr. Murthy talked about with regard to a change in mood or change in functioning, someone not doing as well at work or school. That could be a lot of different things. So we don't always know for sure if that is an addiction problem, but could be assessed and further determined. Other times, again, because of the stigma that he mentioned, the individual who is struggling with it does keep it under wraps. Their family doesn't always know, which makes it harder to get them the help that they need.
Eric Strain, how do families figure this out? How could they? How should they? How do they in the real world?
Well, I think the Surgeon General did a nice job in making some points there about this, that noticing people who have a change in behavior, or a family member, for example, who is on a prescription opioid for, say, a pain condition but seems to be using more of it or using it for reasons other than pain, is certainly a flag. Changes in behavior, as Ann mentioned, which seem atypical for them, could be a flag for either a substance abuse problem or could be some other mental health issue which also needs to be addressed. So when somebody isn't themselves, it's a flag to say, and it's in a persistent way,
mm-hmm.
it's certainly a flag to say, what's going on here?
When someone's addicted, Aaron, and I don't know, it's a family gathering, and maybe it's been noticed over time, and somebody takes the opportunity to say, what's going on here? Do people tend to say, well, I got hooked on my prescription opioids, or, you know, I'm drinking way too much, or is it something that people tend to camouflage, hide?
I think you see it both ways, Tom. You know, when a family member approaches with concern and not confrontation, I think you're more likely to get, you know, the person to really express what's going on with them and to, you know, share what they've been struggling with. And they may not actually have the words or the knowledge to know whether they're addicted or not. They may complain of other problems that might be associated with a substance dependence, such as depression or anxiety or their ongoing chronic pain in the case of opioids. Some folks do become defensive and that and don't always own up to it right away because they're struggling with it perhaps and dealing with the shame and the stigma that was mentioned. But it can be the time to start a conversation by being open and supportive and inquiring what's going on with your loved one without accusing or blaming.
Time to let the stigma go, as the Surgeon General tells us today. But Eric Strain, it still sounds a daunting task. You see someone who's out of sorts or not behaving in a way that's familiar, it may seem like a leap to come to them and say, hey, are you on Oxy or are you on heroin or have you found yourself to be an alcoholic? It seems like a big stretch for often.
Well, I think, Tom, you're right. Yes, I wouldn't say, well, so a loved one seems out of sorts and different from what you'd expect and to say, hey, are you using heroin? That obviously, I mean, I think it comes out of, first of all, it should be thoughtfully done, mm-hmm. and it should be done. I would advocate that the first conversation should be something that perhaps might be in private. So this isn't something
sure. Across the big table.
Afternoon, mm-hmm. yeah, when somebody is carving the turkey.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, to say to them, hey, I've noticed that you don't seem like yourself now, and it's been going on for a while, and I'm concerned about you, and I wonder what's going on, and, you know, is there something going on that maybe I could help you with? And to find out and see what their response is, and that other person may feel a sense of relief, or they may say there's absolutely nothing wrong, or they may misattribute it to something else. But at least the conversation has started so that you've got something to build upon in subsequent conversations with them, especially if you start to accumulate information that suggests that they're misusing medications or drinking to excess.
Is there, Aaron, in your experience, a difference in the way, let's say, opioid addicts might respond to family concern versus an alcoholic? Are there patterns?
I think the thing that can distinguish it at this point, we know that many people who become addicted to opioids have had a chronic pain problem, a legitimate medical condition that has led to the prescribing of this and increased use over time. And so for some of these folks, they feel that this was part of their treatment and it may not be a problem. And so I think that very much distinguishes from alcohol for those individuals. We don't typically prescribe alcohol as a treatment for any medical
mm-hmm,
condition.
Mm-hmm.
So you can definitely see where there might be some differences there for some people.
You mean, so they might be thinking, well, I'm not an addict. I'm just dealing with my pain. This is a medication. It's not a problem?
Yes, that would be something I've definitely heard before from patients who have started on the trajectory of opioid use because of a medical condition where they were legitimately prescribed the medication.
I mean, there's so much of it out there, Eric Strain. What did I read? We're 5% of the world's population and use 99% of its opioids at this point. Is it just become a social norm? So many people are on opioids, they don't think of it as addiction. They think of it as just dealing with difficulty.
Well, I think one of the things to stress, Tom, is that there can be multiple different paths that people arrive at a problem with and with opioids or with any substance. And, you know, it's not a one size that applies to all. But certainly, as Aaron was saying, you know, our current difficulties are because there has been culturally and medically here in this country a lot of opioid prescribing over the last 10, 15, plus years, it has become quite common for us to see these medications being used by loved ones and by neighbors and friends. And there's concurrent with that is has come about a cultural attitude that and a medical attitude that pain is something that needs to be aggressively treated. And the simplest way to treat pain for some providers is to prescribe an opioid.
And there we are. And people may think this is my medication, but it can quickly become more than that. And of course, we've seen this problem of people going from opioid pain medication to the illegal market, heroin, and all the rest. Dr. Eric Strain, please stand by there in Baltimore. And Aaron Bonar in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Ray's calling from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Ray, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I always found family gatherings like Thanksgiving, Christmas, whatever, to be very, very difficult. For me, it took one person, you know, one-on-one to talk to me and to a person that I respected and that I had faith in to help me. But family gatherings were always very uncomfortable for me because it when the issue was raised, it almost became, it felt like an attack. Because, you know, everybody has a different point of view, and but I never found a family able to help me.
I'm glad you found the respected friend who did help you, Ray, and I appreciate your sharing that with us. Aaron, let me ask you about, I'm looking at a Mayo Clinic report here talking about intervention, and they're sort of talking about when families might actually intervene. Now, over the Thanksgiving table seems like too much, but this is a time when people come together. They may be talking about it, Eric. I couldn't tell from the Surgeon General's report if he really favors this kind of intervention, but Mayo Clinic still has material out there talking about, you know, a time when you, as a group, you confront an individual and give examples of destructive behaviors and the impact of an addict on of their addiction on loved ones, lay out some prearranged treatment plan with steps and goals and guidelines, and spell out, they say, what each person will do if a loved one refuses to accept treatment. What about that kind of intervention, Eric? Maybe by a family. Is that still, do you recommend it?
So let me come back to that, but a holiday may be a chance for other members of the family to get together to talk about something, but not necessarily to confront the person if you haven't seen the person a lot.
Yep.
So this can be an opportunity not to disrupt what might otherwise be a joyful time of family together for Thanksgiving by confronting a family member, but it may be a chance to have a quiet conversation, you know, a sidebar conversation with other family members to say, hey, I'm worried about Mama, or I'm worried about Dad, or whoever, and what's been going on with them. Have you had those worries as well? Now, the idea of having interventions, I think, and I'd be certainly curious to hear Aaron's thoughts on this, but I think those have generally fallen out of favor. Those are something that was developed in Minnesota literally decades ago, and really had a very sort of stylistic approach to them. They were called Johnson interventions. You know, there could always be the circumstance where it might be useful for somebody to have one of those. I think that what it suggests is bringing in a professional to be a part of an intervention or part of a confrontation or a discussion with a person. There may be value to that, especially if the family doesn't feel like they've got the skill set and the wherewithal to do this on their own. That may be bringing their physician in, or it may be seeking out some local resource that could be helpful, like a counselor or a therapist.
We've got this new report from the Surgeon General, Aaron, and there they say intervention in the report means a professionally delivered program, service, or policy. It says it does not refer to an arranged meeting or confrontation intended to persuade a friend or loved one to quit their substance abuse, misuse, or enter treatment. So the type of intervention sometimes depicted on television. Is that out now, Erin?
Well, I think that since the Surgeon General really calls attention to that, that's an important note to make. We use the term intervention in the treatment world as meaning a therapy or a specific, like you said, professional program that we're delivering. And the pop culture definition of intervention looks a little bit different, and the original Johnson intervention does as well. What we tend to find is that approaches that are confrontational don't tend to work as well as other types. And so, I think there's a way to raise concern with your family member in a collaborative manner, in a supportive manner, and not fall into the trap of the sort of old intervention that you might see on movies and television where the families are gathering around and sort of airing their grievances, but more to approach the family member with concern and compassion and, you know, here's what I've noticed and let's talk about what might be going on and how we might be able to help you with that.
Still takes some courage to surface these things sometimes. The Surgeon General is saying to us there that he doesn't want these things to be seen as stigmatized or be stigmatized, but we all know what attitudes have been. Debbie in Atlanta, Georgia. Debbie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to address briefly, when you talk about stigma, it's not just the stigma on the alcoholic or drug abuser. There's also a tremendous amount of stigma on the family members that are affected. I know in my personal situation, I got to a point where I was very isolated. I didn't feel like it was something that I could talk about, you know, with other people. And I didn't feel like the people that I knew in church or through school contacts or work contacts had my same experiences.
You mean you had a family member who was struggling with addiction? Debbie, not yourself, but even so, right. You weren't the addict, but to talk about it with others was, you also felt vulnerable to being stigmatized.
Exactly, yes. So the important thing for me is that I had to find my own support and recovery system, and I was able to do that, and that was about 12 years ago. My son, since, has continued to struggle with his addiction and alcoholism and is currently in prison in a recovery program in prison.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just grateful that in those 12 years, as his disease progressed, I was able to get healthier and be able to deal with the situations that came because of his situation and found, you know, a support system that helped me to learn how to detach and have compassion and consider it a disease instead of a failing, a moral failing. So there are programs for the families, and I just feel like it's important for people to know that.
Debbie, I'm so glad you raised that. Erin, how about that? I mean, it can be embarrassing, it can be a source of shame, or it can just be a big source of pain for family members in bringing it up and in wading in.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely something that we see. We see parents come into the clinic who feel a sense of shame or like they failed as parents because this has happened to their child, or they failed their family member in some other way. And, you know, because we know that this is not a moral failing, it's not necessarily a choice someone makes to become addicted, that that it is a brain disease and it does come from many factors, that it isn't the family member's fault. And finding sources of support, either through, you know, their own therapy or through community support groups or just good friends, can be really helpful in managing that when it is occurring in your family.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Goldman Sachs. Get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy in the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth, plus much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's opioid crisis and addiction in the family, how to spot it, how to respond. Aaron Bonar is with us from the University of Michigan Addiction Treatment Services Clinic. Eric Strain is with us from Johns Hopkins and the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment and Research there. You can join us as well this hour. What is your advice to families wrestling with addiction? What's the first step, the second step, the way out? Are you the addict in the family? Does your family know? How could they best help you? And as everyone gathers for Thanksgiving, if there's a problem, will you talk about it or will you look away? Bridget's calling from Pomfret, Connecticut. Bridget, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
We lost our daughter a year ago. She was 27, and we lost her to a heroin overdose. My daughter was never given prescription medications, so the person that she was involved with and have my granddaughter, he also died the same week that my daughter died.
Sorry,
and he had started her on OxyContin, and that's how it had begun. And I have to say that what I have personally experienced is initially, because she started in her addiction in her teens, not with heroin, but, you know, the beginning. When we were going through it, I took 2 years off of work and stayed home while she was in high school. And I would go to the school and I would tell them there's something wrong with her. We had not known, just for a little background, that she had been molested by her best friend's uncle over the course of a couple of years. She never said anything because he had told her that, you know, her father would kill him and he'd go to jail. So she never said a word. My daughter suffered, and I would go to the school and I would tell them she's changed. And I kept getting the same, you know, she's making choices. If I hear anybody else say that she's making choices ever again in my life, I think I'd have to strangle them personally. The hard part was that we tried to get her help in so many different manners. We moved. And we have another son. We have our son. Mm-hmm. And then eventually we had our granddaughter, who we've raised since birth. We tried everything. We were banned from the family because of my daughter's problems. Everybody knew what she was doing, and so we were essentially not just her, but my entire family.
Because they were afraid that she would introduce drugs to others in the family, Bridget? Or just why exactly?
Because there was just something wrong with her, therefore there was something wrong with us, and they didn't want any part of it.
Yeah.
So we were literally banned from the family. We moved. We sold our homes. I lost so much money through the years. I can't even count it at this point. I mean, it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars that my husband and I have lost. There has never been any support. And I have to say that even with all of this information that is coming out, there's still very little support. The general public still sees it as a failing, regardless of what the Surgeon General says, regardless of what the medical community is saying. People still, if you see a feed, and I have my Facebook open to the public because I'm very active. I've done a public service announcement for Connecticut. I'm on two different task forces. I allow anyone to call me if they have that problem. But there is, I had a girl just a month ago, couldn't get her into treatment. By the time they finally did get her treatment, she was already gone. And you don't have time. And that's what people don't understand. There is no time. I mean, when they say that they want help, it has to be done right then, that second. It can't be 2 days later. It can't be 5 days later or 3 weeks. And in the case of my daughter, she did try to get help. The system failed her. I mean, she served 2.5 years in prison. She didn't have custody of her daughter. My daughter was a beautiful human being, but she never, there was no program that addressed the issues that started all of this.
Bridget, stick with us for a second here. Eric Strain, jump in here. I mean, Bridget's experience with her daughter and more just sounds overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming. And in that circumstance, and we were thinking about families here who may be feeling like we've got to do something, is it really that lonely once you step up and step in?
Well, I, first of all, I'm so sorry for your loss and for the events that happened with your daughter and with your family and with your extended family as well. It's it sounds like I think, Tom, there, one of the messages I would say is there are no simple answers to this, and I think that we always are looking for. You know, as a culture, we look for simple answers.
Well, I don't even mean simple answers. Yeah. I mean an answer. It sounds like Bridget struggled and could not find anything that sounded like a reasonable answer.
Well,
and her daughter's dead.
Yeah. I think that that's part of the reason for the Surgeon General to be putting together a report to try to have us, both as a medical community as well as a culture, to recognize that what we've been doing has been failing. This Bridget's story, illustrates exactly that.
Aaron, that doesn't seem like enough. I mean, is in your? I know Eric doesn't mean to suggest.
What do you want?
I'm trying to imagine people listening right now, who may suspect or know that someone in their family is struggling with this, and they would like a way to wade into this where they have some degree of confidence that they'll be able to be helpful, that they won't drown in it themselves, that there's something waiting for them in the medical community or beyond, Aaron, that will click in and help them deal with it. We've got a real national crisis here.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you, Bridget, for sharing that. That's one of the many heartbreaking stories that we've heard because of these issues, and you're really talking about the ways the system has failed you, and unfortunately that's the case for many people. There's breakdowns at all parts of the system. I mean, the Surgeon General does call for early prevention and intervention, and having more of that in schools when kids are young might catch some folks and be able to alter their trajectory, but we also need access to treatment, and that's very difficult. We need providers who are trained and skilled in dealing with screening and treating these problems. And we don't have the silver bullet yet. And I think the thing that Bridget did for her family was to be persistent and to keep trying and to try to get the treatment, to try to get the resources to work with this problem. There's one answer yet.
But who's likely to figure this out? Is the family doctor the place to go, and they have a conversation to ascertain if this is addiction or just prescription painkiller overuse? Aaron?
Definitely family doctors are one point of screening. Your emergency departments, your family doctors, any sort of healthcare provider should be able to start to ask the right questions to identify what's going on and potentially link the person to more intensive treatment if needed. It is encouraged that healthcare providers start to ask their patients about their substance use, alcohol, and other drugs to begin to fill in these gaps in treatment.
Bridget, what would have helped you that you did not find?
Well, I can tell you just from in the last year since my daughter's death, I have, like I said, I belong to a lot of different organizations. I do what I can. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I'm still noting, every rally that I go to and I speak at, every task force meeting, do you know how often these task force meetings get postponed because people have other things to do? Mm-hmm. It's still, to them, it's still not important enough. It hasn't happened to them. And the sadder part is every rally, every forum that I go to, and my first thing when I speak is I ask people, how many of you here have struggled with addiction or have a family member in addiction or have lost a family member to addiction or a loved one? And in the audience, everyone raises their hand. That is the issue right there. It shouldn't be an audience filled with people who are in the depths of this like I am. Mm-hmm. It should be the general public who has children growing up who think that, not my child, no, not my home.
Mm-hmm.
And those people don't show up. Those people think it's your problem. Something mm-hmm. you did, something that she did, whatever it may be. But where do we get to the point where we have, and just quick, like with this election, everybody's outraged. Everybody's got something to say. Everybody's, I mean, I've never seen so many people so upset over an election, and yet people are dying. And if that's brought up, well, we don't want to talk about that. Oh, you know, sorry for your loss. I've heard that enough. I'm not sorry that I have to say that these people belong in that room. We live in a suburb where it's all private schools. My daughter was raised in an area that was, you would never think, but you know what? The best drugs are available at those schools.
Mm-hmm. Bridget,
and I've heard these kids.
Yeah. You're sharing your story is very important to us, and I'm glad that you're sharing it more widely, and I appreciate you sharing it with us today, and I appreciate your call. Aaron Strain is the answer here. Is it political? I mean, in the campaign, there's a lot of talk about shutting off the supply, as in shutting off the border in the Trump campaign, which won. Is that what it ultimately comes back to? Do we have the clinical capacity at the therapy end to handle this wave of addiction that we're looking at?
I'm sorry, Tom, was that to me?
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, we don't. I mean, that's one of the things that comes up in the Surgeon General's report, and he commented earlier in the hour, that, and it's one of the frustrations, is that our treatment system is nowhere near the capacity that it needs to be. And I would further argue that what we need is quality treatment, and so often we will see capacity increased at the cost of decreasing quality of treatment, and a lot of times it's the particularly difficult patients who need high quality treatment and really suffer under these circumstances. They have concurrent psychiatric problems beyond their substance abuse, for example, or they don't have the psychosocial supports that Bridget was bringing to the table. So it's really difficult under those circumstances. I don't think turning off the supply, I don't think you can turn off the supply. If you look in the Old Testament, there's a description of drinking alcohol and how problematic it is. We've been suffering from substance abuse problems for thousands of years.
Yes, but sometimes you have a river of opioids being pumped out by pharmaceutical companies and heroin coming in, and sometimes you don't.
Sure, and I think that as a medical profession, we went through a period where prescription opiates were being widely prescribed, and I think we're seeing that pendulum clearly swing back with the CDC's recommendations and things along those sorts. The problem is that the risk now is that for the current population of people who are using, they're simply going to migrate over to using heroin, I think, or mm-hmm. some proportion of them will. So it helps to decrease the supply, and increasing supply increases the risks, or the availability increases the risk that we'll have more people who are misusing a drug. So decreasing supply can be helpful, but we're never going to be able to turn the spigot off, I don't think.
Aaron, make it just as granular and concrete as you can. I mean, alcoholism is a problem. It has been for a long time, continues to be. The opioid thing has got people's attention right now. In particular, this sort of subtle drift from, I was prescribed some pain medicine, and now I'm not sure. Maybe you've got a cousin or a child saying, "Am I?" or a partner or yourself, "Am I addicted now?" What's the first step, Darren? If someone in the family is feeling that way and you spot they're having trouble, okay, maybe they acknowledge that they are or they wonder if they are, what do you say? Okay, let's do what, Aaron?
Yeah, I think the first thing to do is to seek an evaluation of some sort from a medical professional. You could start with your primary care physician. Otherwise, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, the SAMHSA website, SAMHSA.gov, has resources for finding providers in your community. I would start there. If that's available to you, that's certainly a resource and can start the trajectory to recovery.
Do you usually have to pry out of people that they're fearing addiction? If they're addicted, maybe they don't want to put their supply at risk.
That's certainly a tension. That the nature of this disease is to keep using to keep the withdrawal at bay. Yet at the same time, people have lots of other difficulties in their life that they can attribute to their circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so they tend to be ambivalent and are certainly looking for relief in one way or another.
Eric, if it was your brother, your child, what's the first thing you say?
Well, first of all, the first thing I say is I have a conversation with the other family members about it. Mm-hmm. So I don't go into this alone because mm-hmm. I think that the risk there is that it becomes a one-on-one sort of confrontation, but mm-hmm. to have a group. And then to, if I'm a medical professional, I'm going to approach it differently, but as opposed to a layperson may not, if I was a layperson, I would say, getting help there from, if it's a skilled PCP, that's great. Sometimes PCPs aren't going to have that, and then that skill set in their toolbox, and then I'm going to seek out professional help, a therapist, a counselor of some sort.
But bring it up
yes.
with the family, mm-hmm. act on it one way or another. Dr. Eric Strain at Johns Hopkins, we're very grateful to you for being with us from Baltimore today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Aaron Bonar at University of Michigan's Addiction Treatment Services Clinic. Aaron, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Our thanks to U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivette Murthy as well. Good luck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.